Good afternoon. Welcome. Welcome. So the title of the talk this afternoon is Calm Abiding. Calm Abiding in the Heart. I want to talk about meditation today. And I want to talk about the method of meditation and the spirit of meditation. There's a lot of good method out there in the wide world of meditation. How many of you know Headspace? How many of you use Headspace? A few of you do, yeah. Yeah, so Headspace is an app. You know, a generation ago, Headspace was not available as a way to teach meditation, but I know a lot of people have really found it a helpful avenue into learning how to meditate. But I also want to talk about the spirit of meditation, which has to do with the devotional aspects of this that we do in here. I have a good buddy who's a retired physician, and he was having an MRI, and he came out of the tube of the MRI. If you've had an MRI, it's just incredibly loud and lots of racket. And you know, if you got your eyes open, the ceiling of the tube that you're in is just right there, sort of staring at you. So he got out and he told the technician, he said, "Man, I sure was glad I had a meditation practice in there." And he told me that how grateful he has been to be here and to have his meditation practice. I want to talk to you a little bit about how I meditate in the morning. Typically, I get up and I meditate for 30 or 45 minutes. You know, I don't have young children in the house. I don't have anybody I'm living with. And so, you know, it's pretty easy logistically for me to set that up, to manage that. I know that's not easy for everybody here. But I think of this as sort of like a central core and bookends. And the bookends are taking refuge and dedicating merit. And the middle is what we did in our guided meditation today, which is called calm abiding. So taking refuge, and we have done this occasionally here, is just noticing, where do you find refuge in your life? And classically, we take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. If you're practicing out of a Buddhist frame, it's in the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, but also the awakened awareness that is in the heart of every sentient being. We take refuge in that. We take refuge in the Dharma, which is the teaching of the Buddha, but it's also in reality itself, in the way things are. That's another translation of the word Dharma. And then we take refuge in the Sangha, or the community, or I like to say the Mahasangha, which is really the great Sangha, forward and backwards in time. All the Buddhas, all the Bodhisattvas of all the universes, all the teachers, all the lineage of, you know, this teaching has been passed down, as Buddhists like to say, from warm heart to warm heart, from one person to the next for 2,500 years. You know, we wouldn't be doing this here without that lineage of transmission. And it's true with the gospel as well. So I might take refuge in Jesus, in the Christ, in his teaching, the gospel of freedom, the gospel of liberation, and refuge in the community of saints and angels and, again, the whole lineage of transmission. And there could be any number of other places that we find ourselves taking refuge. Might be a particular teacher a particular practice of been talking with someone who's really finding refuge in Ram Dass's teacher named Karoli Baba. And in the music of Krishna Das's kirtan, that's a real refuge for him right now. It's a place of stability and safety. So one bookend is taking refuge, and the other bookend is dedicating merit. And that's simply a reminder that we are not just in here for ourselves. Yeah, for sure, I am in here for myself. The great Jewish teacher Hillel says, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, who will be for others? So we do it for the benefit of all beings, this practice is. And it widens the heart when we remember that it's not just about chilling out. Though there's nothing wrong with chilling out. So here are the two bookends, but the central part is what we did today, this calm abiding. And I like to think of calm abiding as sort of a three-legged stool. The first leg is grounding, and the second leg is breathing, and the third leg is allowing. So we've done that, and I don't think I need to elaborate greatly, but I do want to say a few things about this. I want you to think about the reality or the lack thereof of support in your life. And just where is support for you? You know, some of us, you know, along the spectrum of support, some of us feel well supported. We're supported by a cadre of friends, colleagues, family, or, you know, maybe some of that support is more robust in some areas and, you know, less in others. There's some of us who have, who are in a desert of support, for whom it really doesn't feel like there's anybody on whom it's safe to rely. And then there's this great spectrum in between. And just see what's true for you. You may be living with somebody and you may feel well understood, well supported, or you know, somewhat and somewhat not, or maybe somewhat really not. You know, what's true for you? And support can come and go. You know, it may be there in one season of our lives and it may be relatively absent in another. So when we take our seat, Jack Kornfield likes to say, this one seat between earth and heaven. We take this one seat and I like to feel into the sensations of support. You know, the Buddha said, there are four postures that we are moving around in all day. We are either standing or moving or sitting or lying down. And in every case, the earth is supporting us. You know, we live in such air-conditioned spaces, and it's nice this time of year, but we live in such interior spaces that we can often get deracinated, get uprooted, unconnected with the earth. So it's useful to remember, there's earth that is supporting this sanctuary, that's supporting this floor, that's supporting this chair, that's supporting my body. And we can really feel into, here's the reality of whatever other support there is, or absence of support. There is the support of this seat in this moment, right now. And I may be carrying a lot of tension, a lot of resistance to my life. I may feel fairly comfortable, or really comfortable, really at ease. But I can drop whatever is true for me into the support of the chair. And especially if there is tension, not trying to get rid of it, but just to allow it to be there. That allowing is the key, and we'll come to that. And then there's breathing. And the physiology of the breathing is very simple. It's 3 minutes of soft belly breathing shuts down the stress response. It's just a physiological fact. It happens at the level of the hypothalamus in the midbrain. And, you know, you can try it for yourself. And especially with this breathing in the belly, you might imagine a balloon being inflated in the belly. And then not squeezed out, but just the breath just kind of falls out of that balloon. And when we can drop into that rhythm, there's just this natural tidal rhythm, like the movement of the waves at the seashore. And we don't control that. That just has its own rhythm. And when we can find the breath as our refuge, that is a major moment of discovery in the life of meditation. That's a very important discovery. When that happens, we may notice, however fleeting, oh, it gets quiet in there. This is possible for me to access this refuge of inner stillness. The mind may crank up again, and that's just fine. There's no problem with that. But this inner stillness is possible. And then there's allowing. As I said in the meditation, allowing is the key to the door of meditation. Ajahn Chah just gives one meditation instruction. He didn't say anything about following your breath. He didn't say anything about grounding. He just says, allow everything to be the way it is. And that's really enough. You know, we can notice this moment of, you know, I'm not liking my meditation so much. I don't think I'm doing it right. Allow that. Yeah. This is great. I have arrived. You know, I'm finally getting it. Allow that. It'll pass. Everything's impermanent. It all passes. But allowing is the key to this one thing that is permanent, which is impermanence. I've said this before. Somebody asked Suzuki Roshi, you know, what's the essence of Buddhism? And he said, everything changes. Everything changes. That means that nothing is absolutely reliable except this that is reliable. And that's what we're going to talk about. So calm abiding has these kind of three pieces of grounding and breathing and allowing. And I take refuge. I do a little mantra, and I'll say about that in a minute. Then I do this calm abiding. And that really sets the stage for the rest of the meditation. You know, there are lots of different ways of working with breathing. A famous one, and the Zen folks use this a lot, is counting breaths. When I was first learning concentration meditation from the Zen folks, they would teach me to count my breaths, and it was just count to 10. And it was like, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10. But then it got a little bit more sophisticated, and I could count backwards. It sort of keeps your mind on your number. Count backwards, 10, 9, 8. And if you really want to keep yourself from going to sleep, you can do it on your fingers. So like 1, 2, in-breath, out-breath, 3, 4. You know, you go to your other hand and you got 10. I found that if I did 10 rounds of 10 breaths, that was about 30 minutes. You can check it out with your own breathing rate. And one of the things that my Zen teachers said is, you know, as a kind of entering capacity that we would like to nurture, building some concentration muscle, because concentration does bring calmness, as a kind of entering capacity, we'd like to be able to, you know, pretty much meditate for 30 minutes without the mind wandering. That may seem like to you like a pretty high bar. But with dedication, you can do that why do that? You know, why bother? We'll come to that in a minute. So I have on my wrist what's called a mala, and a mala is just a string of 108 beads. So counting breaths is a way to stabilize the mind. But so is using a mala. Mala is like a rosary in the Catholic world. And, you know, you can just count breaths here. You know, and there's something about the tactile sense of having these beads in my hand. I think this is true for those who grew up counting their beads, you know, in the Catholic tradition. Just having the rosary in hand is a connection with the sacred. And so too, in the Hindu and the Buddhist tradition, having the mala in hand, just there's just a muscle memory. It just kind of takes you right there. So, you know, you can count breaths, or you can count mantras. The mantra literally means a guard of the heart. Such a nice phrase. So, you know, it might be a mantra like, you know, the Lord is my shepherd. And I just keep, you know, with each bead, the Lord is my shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. Or it might be Hail Mary, full of grace. And I might do the whole, you know, Ave Maria. Or, you know, it might be I use a Tibetan mantra, Om Tare Ture Soha. Homage to the Mother of Buddhas, the victorious ones. That's how that translates. And, you know, you can do it kind of mechanically so that there's no real devotional feel. But if you make contact with Tara, who's the Mother of Buddhas, or Mary, the Mother of God, as she's called in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, when you make contact with the presence of that person, there's nothing mechanical about it. There's real heart resonance with that presence. So counting breaths, using a mala, all these are ways to kind of stabilize the mind, stabilize the tension. I was talking with a client who was with me this week, and he was just outraged about something. And from my seat, he was justifiably outraged. I was outraged hearing about his story. And he told me his story, and he said, I'd really like to hear any instruction, any thoughts that you have about this. And I said, well, we'll talk about the practical aspects first, because you got to deal with this outrage practically. But then I want to talk about what I think I've got to really give. You can talk to any number of people, any number of colleagues about the practical aspect of this, but I want to talk about the meditative aspect of this. And so, after we did the, you know, kind of practical stuff, then I said, so let's do a little bit of this grounding and breathing and allowing. And we, you know, we did that. And it's reminding me right now when my wife Kathy got her cancer diagnosis and came home and shared that. And, you know, we talked about the practicalities, you know, what had to happen next and who the oncologist was going to be and who the surgeon was going to be and all that kind of stuff. And then we did walking meditation just downstairs in our house. And walking meditation is another form of concentration meditation, which just involves the body. So that's what we were doing with what I was doing with this client, this man in my office. And as it did with Kathy, the situation was still there. The outrage was still there, and he had to deal with it. Cancer diagnosis was still there. But now it was being held in a much bigger space. And then from that larger space, our conversation could unfold in a different way than if we had not done this calm abiding. Calm abiding is our English translation for a Sanskrit word, which is shamatha. Shamatha is the beginning move in meditation. Calm abiding. If we don't lay the groundwork with shamatha, then it's difficult to move on to the next stages of meditation. While I was writing this talk, you know how you'll get these emails that kind of scroll across your screen? I got this email that said, quick lessons from the Dalai Lama. And I thought, well, man, quick lessons from the Dalai Lama. I'm going to look at that email. So I left working on the talk, and I went to quick lessons from the Dalai Lama. And I kid you not, it was a one-minute teaching from the Dalai Lama. He's teaching Dan Rather how to meditate. It was great. And basically, he was teaching Dan Rather what I was teaching my client, which is just, you know, here's something that's upsetting. And he was just teaching him to count his breaths. But what was really interesting was Dan Rather. Dan Rather had the look of a child on his face. It was so sweet. I want to tell you, you've never seen this look on Dan Rather's face. You know, I mean, 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace, you know, you are these hard-ass reporters. But here's Dan Rather talking to the Dalai Lama, and he has this openness of countenance, which is just beautiful to behold. And it reminded me of the psychologist, Dr. Ekman, who had a chronic problem with major big-time rage. And he was doing some consulting with the Dalai Lama about emotions and meditation. And he took his daughter to one of these conferences with the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama just sat and held both their hands while he talked to them for about 15 minutes. And Ekman said, I don't know how this happened, but when I left that sitting with the Dalai Lama and my daughter, I did not have the chronic rage that I have had for my entire life. He said, there was some kind of energetic transmission that was going on from that man. Now, that's the kind of thing that can happen with a truly realized being. All of which to say is, this practice can really, really make a difference for us. You know how YouTube queues up the next thing that they think you want to watch after you watch the Dalai Lama and Dan Rather for a minute? Well, the next thing was celebrities who meditate. And it was Will Smith, and it was LeBron James, and it was Ellen DeGeneres, and it was, of course, Oprah. And Oprah teaching everybody who works for her how to meditate. And it was really just kind of a sweet thing. And it says how meditation has really just oozed into the culture. I mean, you know, when I was a rookie Episcopal priest, ain't nobody who was talking about meditation very much, except for the Beatles, who had gone to learn how to meditate in India. And maybe, you know, the TM folks. What a sea change culturally this is that we have been heir to, you know, in our own time. I want to read you something that this comes from a Tibetan teacher, young Tibetan teacher named Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. Sakyong Mipam is the son of Chogyam Trungpa, who was really the first major Tibetan teacher to bring Tibetan Buddhism to the West. And this is what Sakyong Mipam has to say about meditation. He says, just like the Buddha, most of us would like to discover some basic truth about our life. But are we really capable of knowing what's going on? This is a question that relates to the most profound truth of the Buddhist teachings. The Buddha's answer is yes, ultimately, we are capable of knowing what's going on. But we need to go on a journey of meditation to find out, because essentially, we are in a state of bewilderment. Why are we bewildered? Because we don't understand how our mind works. The process of undoing bewilderment is based on cultivating the ability to become familiar with, stabilize, and strengthen our mind. Being aware and observant of what's happening in our mind gives us an opportunity to see a more profound level of truth all the time. In the practice of meditation, we learn to zoom back and get a bigger perspective rather than always thinking so small. So I've used the analogy with you before of kind of three lenses of meditation, and calm abiding is a rather focused lens. It focuses on the sensations of support, the movement of breathing in the belly, and then this sense of allowing. The next move, shamatha, calm abiding, gives way to vipassana, which means clear seeing, or the Tibetans pronounce it vipassana. It's the same thing. It means choiceless awareness. Why is awareness choiceless? Because it doesn't make any choices. If you think about what's coming down the stream of your awareness right now, you don't have any choice about what's here. And that is the nature of awareness. That can feel sometimes unwelcome because we don't like what is in our field of awareness. Or other times it's really sweet. But either way, whether we like it or we don't, here's awareness which is not making any choices. And as we move from calm abiding to this larger allowing of choiceless awareness, then we realize, oh, I can actually be present. This choiceless awareness, this more open lens, is awareness to the 10,000 joys and sorrows of my life. That's the kind of middle lens. The largest lens is what we would call the awareness of awareness itself. The Tibetans call this dzogchen, or sky-like mind. And this is when we actually, it's what Sakyam Mipham says when we really zoom out. When we turn awareness back on itself, and we're aware not so much of the contents of awareness, but of the awareness that's holding it. It's like with this bell, there are different contents that could be poured into and poured out of this bell. But what we become aware of is the actual bell that's holding all these different contents. And in that space, it's just wide open. So I want to give you a personal example of this. This is a story that ends well. So about 2 weeks ago, I was having some old man bladder issues, so I went to see my urologist, who's a buddy of mine, and he said, I tell you what, I want to get a CT scan. And so we got a CT scan, and that showed that there were bladder stones, and that can be dealt with. But he said the CT scan also showed a lesion on your pancreas. And I think we need to get that checked out. He said, it's really small. He said, I'm not worried about this. But due diligence, we need to get this checked out. So I want you to have an MRI. My beloved Aunt Shelby, my sister's mother, died of pancreatic cancer when I was a divinity school student. And then, of course, our dear friend Jimmy Pilkerton just died this last year of pancreatic cancer. So, you know, it's not a trivial diagnosis. And I got my friends, he was very even about this, you know. He gave it to me in a beautifully centered way. By the way, he's a devoted practitioner of centering prayer. So he and I have this, you know, kind of meditative deal going together. And so I had the MRI on Monday. And again, I was glad I had a meditative practice too when I was in the racket of the MRI for about 35 minutes. And then I was just waiting, you know, to see what the diagnosis would be. And as I would walk around the neighborhood, oh, I should tell you one other thing. When he told me that I needed to have the MRI, it's kind of matter of fact, and these kinds are, they're kind of time delay for me. But I got home, and I found myself really feeling vulnerable. I just thought, you know, it really would have been nice to be able to have Kathy to go through this with. And I just felt vulnerable. And so I just cried for a little while. And that was just a very cleansing weeping. And then, like, I was okay after that. And then I had the MRI. And then I was just kind of walking around the neighborhood. And I thought, just like me, there are millions of people around the world today who are waiting for results from tests. Right? I mean, this is not something that's peculiar to me. And this is to give you a clue about where I want to go in the talk next week. I want to talk about the Tibetan practice of Tonglen, or taking and sending. So what I was doing was just breathing in all those people who are waiting. Just breathing in and breathing that into my heart space. And you know, when we're waiting for a diagnosis, we're frankly fairly self-centered about it. You know, I'm kind of like the center of the universe and I want to get the results, right? So what we're doing with this practice is we're breathing into the heart space, into that self-centeredness that we all have, right? And this is paradoxical. I don't exactly know how this works, but the Tibetans figured it out. That if you breathe in suffering of other people and it comes into your heart space, there is some kind of big bang. And what goes out is this radiance of compassion. You know, I've told y'all before that the novelist Alice Miller said that Tonglen practice saved her life. And the Tibetans have, you know, anecdotal evidence of people doing this practice and their diseases getting cured. Okay? I don't personally know about that, but they testify to that. So anyway, I'm breathing in, you know, just the anxiety of people who are waiting, the fear of people who are waiting, and breathing out this radiance. And you know, with each breath, I'm just doing my walk, you know, with each breath, you know, it was just like, the great field of compassion is holding all of us. And that's true. That's a true statement. We're just more or less in contact with it or not. We're just more or less awakened to it. So the Sanskrit word bodhicitta means bodhi is awake and citta is mind, heart. Bodhicitta is the awakened mind, heart, which is radiant with compassion. This heart is empty like this bell. It's empty because it receives anything in your life, anything in anybody else's life. It's choiceless. It just receives. It's empty and it's compassionate. The emptiness is the wisdom part of the practice. The compassion is the emotional part of the practice. And the Tibetans like to say that we need, this is like two wings of the eagle. You know, two wings of the bird. We need the emptiness piece and we need the compassion piece as well. Last thing I want to say is I think that meditation is the way to bring the mind home. Meditation is bringing the mind and the heart home to our long lost home. If you feel lost in the world, if you feel lost in your life, meditation is a way to come home. Thich Nhat Hanh has this wonderful gatha. I know some of you who are students of his know this. His gatha, his little verse is, "I have arrived. I am home." This I could be the egoic I, the walking around personality I, but it could also be the big I. You know, it's like, I, compassion, I'm where home is. I am home. I have arrived, I am home, in the here and the now. I am solid, I am free, in the infinite I dwell. What a beautiful gatha. Kathy and I used to say that together before her chemotherapies. I have arrived, I am home, in the here and the now. I am solid. I am free. No matter what the circumstances outwardly of my life, in the infinite I dwell. So here's a poem. It's by Jane Hooper. I've read this before, but it's apropos for this. It's called "Please Come Home." Please come home. Please come home. Find the place where your feet know where to walk, and follow your own trail home. Please come home. Please come home into your own body, your own vessel, your own earth. Please come home into each and every cell and fully into the space that surrounds you. Please come home. Please come home to trusting yourself and your instincts and your ways and your knowings and even the particular quirks of your personality. Please come home. Please come home, and once you are firmly there, please stay a while and come to a deep rest within. Please treasure your home. Please love and embrace your home. Please get a deep, deep sense of what it's like to be truly home. Please come home. And when you're ready, really ready, and there's a detectable urge on the out-breath, then please come out. Please come home and please come forward. Please express who you are to us. And please trust us to see you and hear you and touch you and recognize you as best we can. Please come home. Please come home and let us know all the nooks and crannies that are calling to be seen. Please come home and let us know the more that is there that wants to come out. Please come home. For you belong here now. You belong among us. Please inhabit your place fully so we can learn from you, from your voice and your ways and your presence. And when you feel yourself home, please welcome us too. For we too forget that we belong and are welcome, and that we are called to express fully who we are. Please come home, you and you and you and me. Please come home. Thank you, Earth, for welcoming us. And thank you, touch of eyes and ears and skin, touch of love for welcoming us. May we wake up and remember who we truly are. Please come home. Please come home. And by the way, the results of the MRI were, it was a benign adenoma cyst, and it was just fine. So, that's it for a moment. so as we come home to being supported in this one spot between heaven and earth. Let your breathing find you. And notice that your awareness is allowing everything to be just as it is. And see yourself in heart contact with someone with whom you are at home. And again, this might be a person here on this side of the veil, someone on the other side of the veil, a spiritual teacher, a deity. And making this heart-to-heart connection. Hear them say to you, "May you be safe and protected. May you be welcomed and loved just as you are. May you be safe and protected and welcomed and loved." And we say back to these protecting, welcoming figures, "May you too be safe and protected and welcomed and loved." And see who's dear in your heart. You know, who you just naturally love. And make that heart-to-heart connection. And say to them, "May you be safe and protected and welcomed and loved." And they say to you, "May you be safe and protected and welcomed and loved." And we can do this with strangers, with people whose names we don't know. It's nice to do this with one person who you see sort of often, but you don't know their name, like the school crossing guard, or mail carrier, whoever it might be, and say to them, "May you too be safe and protected and welcomed and loved." They too, like us, want to be safe and protected and welcomed and loved. They're always protected in the great space of presence and spirit. We all are. Without exception. And picture them saying to you too, "May you be safe and protected and welcomed and loved." And then of course we invite people who, who don't like us, who have difficulty with us, who are disturbed by us, people that we don't particularly like. People who get under our skin, who aggravate us. And see who comes to your mind. And see if your heart is willing to come into contact with their heart. It might be a person, it might be a whole group of persons. And just see if you can say, "Truly, may you be safe and protected. May you too be welcomed and loved." And if you find that your heart is closed and just can't do that, say to your closed heart, "May you be safe and protected and welcomed and loved just as you are, closed down. You too deserve to be safe and protected and welcomed and loved." And finally, we send this out in the widest possible circumference to all beings, all sentient beings, all formless beings, May all beings be safe and protected and welcomed and loved. And so we always end our practice by dedicating the merit of our practice. Whatever good, whatever insight, whatever compassion we have received today, we freely give it out. We let go of it and offer it to. See who you'd like to dedicate the merit of your practice to today. A particular person, perhaps. A particular group of people. And finally, to all beings. Dedicate the merit of our practice to all beings, without exception, that they may be safe and protected and welcomed and loved and come to joy and happiness and to the ending of suffering. So I've got an idea that I want to share with y'all. I have just finished a really grand book by my teacher, Guy Armstrong. Guy's my favorite teacher at Spirit Rock. And I've been waiting for decades for him to write this book, and finally he has written it. And it's a book called Emptiness, a practical Meditator's Guide. And I'd like to do a study group on this book. And I haven't figured out the logistics of that, you know, kind of when I might do that. But I'd like to, you know, just see what kind of appetite there is for doing a study group. You can email me at gordonpierman@gmail.com if you think you might be interested in this. I probably, to make this available to the widest number of people, I would probably do this on the weekend. Maybe an early Sunday morning when I wasn't doing the service at St. Augustine's. I have to think about this. Y'all tell me what would work for y'all. But if you got energy for that, if you're interested in that, just email me. So thank you, as always, for the kindness of your presence, for the generosity of your listening, for what you give in the baskets in back and online at our One River Nashville website. It's a way to give tax deductibly. Thank you. Thank you. Have a great week. See you next week.